I'm just going with the flow, so.
You're listening to Three Wise Truck Guys from Key Advisors.
Hey, good afternoon out there. It's Keith Ely from the Three Wise Truck Guys. I've got John Whitnell with me and Mark Martinsik. John's back from Hawaii again. That's where he was on a sabbatical again last month, I think. Isn't that the truth, John? Or I guess we're just making that one up.
I don't go to Hawaii nearly. I wish I went there as often as I'm accused of going there, but it's good to be back. Can I say that?
You can. You can. As long as you mean it. So
I do. I'm worried. I told Mark before we got started here, I'm worried about this becoming the Two Wise Truck Guys. Too many unexcused absences and you're out.
No. Yeah, we couldn't do it without you, John.
That's right. That's
just
right.
Be the same.
That's right. So what's happening out there, guys? Last month we talked about service throughput. Let's just start as we normally do. Something that was good, something not so good. And, John, I'll let you kick it off. Your observations.
Well, hey, thanks. Listen, I'm gonna approach this from the best first. And, we're starting to see the OEMs increasing throughput capacity, starting to be more and more trucks released and retail sales going up accordingly. The one positive thing that I'm seeing is, it hasn't increased so much where you could start to really start increasing stock inventory levels, but we've all become very efficient at stock and inventory the last 2.5-3 years. And I'm seeing a lot of discipline from dealers around being careful about not trying to stock too much stuff and waste gross margin with floor plan interest costs. So I still a lot of discipline in place, and dealers who've gotten used to gross profit flowing down to the bottom line. And I think that's really positive. On the other end of the spectrum, I just was asked to speak at a 20 group. And one of the items that we've been asked to speak on is helping us find talented sales managers, talented salesmen. Where do we go to find these guys? And the reality is they're not out there, okay? So I think one of the realities that dealers are going to have to get used to is they're going to have to take a chance and start developing their own talent. They're going to have to be very intentional about putting together their own programs to develop their talent, both sales talent and managerial talent. They're very slow to react to that. They're still waiting for these guys and gals to fall out of trees, and it's just not going to happen.
Yep. That is true. That is very true. It's a... the salespeople is on my list today too. So, I'll bring that up when we get there, Mark.
Great minds think alike.
I'm kind of on the same track. Only, for fixed operations, specifically service. Okay, but the focus on getting technicians is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and unfortunately, what I see is, raises and pay, which in its own isn't bad, okay, but I see a lack of what really matters, which is building the culture that the tech wants to stay there, that he feels part of a team, that he knows his specific role and so forth. Certainly hiring a qualified tech for $5 more an hour may get you the tech until the next dealer down the road raises it another $5 and so forth. And some dealers have taken a pretty big swing at it and either eroded their gross profit or raised their rate and so forth to maintain it. Obviously, if your costs go up, your selling price should go up, okay? But not too many successfully. There just is no onboarding plan. There's no training plan, particularly if I bring in a lesser than journeyman technician. Okay, the costs are actually higher than your best technicians when you calculate that they're not either not punched on, or if they are punched on, their efficiency is so bad you're doubling and tripling your costs on each job, and not affecting the volume or your capacity for a couple of years. And unfortunately, only one out of three typically stay that couple of years and make it. So it's a mess right now. And there's a few dealers that have done a pretty good job with focusing on the culture and the pay and the role that you play in the organization's success. And I think that really is the way to go about it. Make it a place people want to come to work and be competitive with your pay in your market. But I don't think you have to be the highest to keep techs.
How far out of hand are you seeing it, Mark?
Oh, I've seen it raise 20 and 25% in hourly wages. Okay, some try incentive programs. The problem is the incentive programs typically are only reachable by the best techs, which is good for them. Okay, but the rest of the techs, if they can't make it, they feel it's a non-entity. It doesn't matter. It can't get there. It's too far out. Okay. And one size does not fit all in a technician incentive plan.
What about on the good side, Mark? Anything, or is that combined?
Yeah, just combined. I can't call out. I'm not going to mention names, but the couple dealers that are doing it really, really well, okay, as I said, have worked on their culture, worked on the importance and talk about it of the technicians, and invested in those technicians in training, real training and experience, and reward that once they achieve it significantly to get them to want to do it. If I'm going to make $2 more an hour to spend a lot of time at home doing all these training things, I'm not so sure it's worth it, okay? But if it makes a significant difference and it improves, tied to improved performance, now it's worth it to the dealer and to the technician and to the customer, by the way, because all of a sudden we have more capacity and we turn jobs quicker.
Right.
Keith, look, just dovetailing Mark and my comments together. It doesn't matter whether it's a salesman, a sales manager, a tech, there's a lot more to this game. And if people think that your dealership is capable of developing talent, if they think that your dealership is offers careers, right? Not right. Just a particular job, you're giving me an opportunity to grow in my career. And let's not ever lose sight of the fact that the number one, they may tell you they're leaving for more money, but the number one reason people leave their jobs is because their boss is a jerk, right? So
right.
And it's hard to bring those three things into alignment, establishing a culture where we develop talent, establishing a culture where we promote within, and we offer exciting career opportunities, and we've got bosses that are capable of developing you and enhancing and promoting your career and being good guys, good people to work for. That's difficult. It's hard. And that's why everybody's looking for these guys to fall out of trees.
And to that point, John, okay, I mean, that's right on, okay? To that point, in 33 years of consulting and all the dealers I've seen, which has been a lot, I'll bet you less than 30% of them even have a documented process, let alone a documented career path, okay, with specific requirements for each section that motivates somebody, that shows them a career path. Okay, I guess in the old days, certainly when I was in a dealership, if you needed a tech, you hired somebody, and if he didn't work out, you just fired him in 2 weeks and hired somebody else, right? Because there was plenty out there to go around. Today, it's a different world.
Yep.
Let's not lose sight. The first building block in any of developing talent and promoting from within is doing employee reviews, right? So we're talking about sort of astrophysics here, right? If you really want to take that first step in terms of developing a culture where you can retain people, and develop people, start with making sure that your staff's done performance reviews
take responsibility to make sure they're two-way performance reviews, right?
Right.
Okay. So get that person involved, get some buy-in.
Interesting stuff.
Some of these guys found out they wasn't working for Key Advisors anymore. So that's why you can do it. That's a good move.
This is true. Hey, so I appreciate both those. I've got one that is kind of in line with John. I would say it's the not so good. And I've been at two or three dealerships in the last 60 days. And the conversation it happened to be centered around truck sales, all three visits. And the conversation with the sales manager, and the GM or the CEO, whatever that role is, was kind of the first one. I couldn't believe I was hearing it, but when I heard the next two, and they're not connected by OE, certainly by ownership, and so they wouldn't have had any idea that the others said this, but their talk track was something along the lines of, "Hey, we've got a significant number of our truck salespeople that after this pipeline gets done clearing itself out, that have told us that they're going to leave after they get these deliveries done, that they're ready to retire." And it's not like one or two salespeople. It's a significant volume or a significant number of these salespeople. And it really concerned me. I mean, and to your point, John, it's not like they can just go pick somebody off the street and drop them into that role and do that. And so, you know, the whole motivation of the salespeople, keeping the salespeople certainly engaged, but keeping them at the dealership, to me anyway, appears from these anecdotal conversations to be something that's concerning.
But don't you think that's as much about culture of the dealership and feeling like I have meaningfulness or feeling like I'm part of something, knowing what my role is and so forth?
You know, I would have, Mark, if it wasn't for the three that I'm talking about. You know, those, the three that I'm thinking about and have heard this from, I'm not so sure. I'm sure it has something to do with it. I think it's also that this looks like a pretty good break point for them. And it's not that these are not people that are 45 years old or 40 years old. You know, they're 50, 55 in that range, but a decent ways away from retirement.
Keith, you know, the graying of this industry is something that we've been talking about probably for a decade, right? And it's not a truck sales issue, right? This isn't the parts department. Mark, this is something the service guys deal with every day because, you know, at some point in time, you can't do the work that you used to do as a technician. So this is an issue in all departments. I guess I'd say what makes a challenge for the truck sales department in particular is because I think everybody acknowledges that customers buy trucks from people they know, like, and trust, right? And so when these graying people retire, you can't just plug somebody in there tomorrow and expect them to be able to do the same work, even if they have the technical skills to spec out a truck properly. You know, it's that customer rapport. So again, that it takes a long time to have a pipeline of new talent that's already maybe met some of these customers, learned the basics of truck. It's about long-term developing the talent within your organization. And this issue here that you just talked about just illustrates how important it is to be thinking about this stuff.
Yep.
And not just for your sales guys, but for all your leadership departments, positions for sure.
Yep. On the flip side of this, I don't know, you guys would probably remember better than me the time frame that we did this in, but we did a couple of podcasts, I'd guess a year and a half ago maybe, on DMS utilization, functionality utilization, maybe even a little bit on conversion. I think the topic of the conversation was, first of all, to if you've got an issue with the functionality of your business system, work with your current business system provider. And then if you're making a move to change DMSs, you know, to consider your workflows, your processes, your setups, everything that needs to support those workflows. And we got asked by one of our customers and their DMS that they're changing to do I'd call it a soup to nuts engagement on the parts department in terms of build out of inventory setups and tools and reportings and building the SOPs and doing all that prior to the install. The install is about a year away, but they want to do this now so that when they go live, that they've got all that trained to and that they're ready to go. And I think the most cool, I don't know if that's the right term, but the really good thing about this was their DMS encouraged them to do that, to be ready for the changeover, to be ready for the go live, and to look at the workflows, and so that their business system, the TMS provider's business system, could be optimized from day one. And that's kudos to that to that company and that dealership. So that to me was a real win to see out in the, not because we got it, but because it's something that we've all talked about and something that's important.
Just another piece of evidence somebody's listening to these podcasts, huh?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I think so. All right. Well, let's get started, guys. Mark, what did we learn from our last podcast? I know we had JB Ream with us. I thought that was a fantastic discussion we had. What did we learn from our last podcast?
Well, you know, if I remember right, you started talking about the importance of absorption, particularly fixed absorption and total absorption and capacity increases. Kind of goes back to my comments earlier about getting technicians and so forth. Okay. And I really think it's more about technicians and their performance than it is about service bays, because there's not too many stores that are open 24/7, but they're paying for 24/7. Okay. But from that, when we talked to JB, I thought he really talked about the things that they have accomplished, okay, that supports that absorption discussion you had. Would you agree?
Yes. Yes.
You know, his focus has become, whether it was before or not, I'm not sure, I wasn't there, but his focus has become on creating flow and sustaining that flow in a service department.
I thought the other piece that, and I found it very interesting, and not just interesting, but the, how important it was to him, which was the idea of being paperless.
Right.
You know, that there wasn't paper lying everywhere, that paperless system, either because they streamlined it or because it forced it to streamline to become paperless, really was a big deal to he and his team.
Yeah, I agree. And for any dealer listening, you don't just go paperless overnight. I think that was when he talked through all the different steps that we went through, okay, or at least all the different results that he saw. Okay, it was a progression until you had the structure in place to go paperless, right? And once yep. you've done that, then everybody has access that you want to have access to the every particular repair order flow that you've got going. If that's 100, if that's 200, everybody has instant access, live access once you've done that.
So I know that we've been engaged with them for a while. Can you just give an idea or give us our approach, how your staff approached that project? And I guess it'd be similar with other projects, but can you just give us an idea of how they approached that project?
Wow. That was a year-long project. So, you know, as you heard, if you listened to the last podcast, the results were great, and I believe typical of what we do for most of our all of our clients. Okay, but every project is different. There's different opportunities, different challenges, and so forth. And so if I start thinking about this, before you would think we just go in and start implementing, but before that, we need to gain buy-in from the frontline team. Well, it's a little bit easier to get a dealer or a general manager or a director to recognize the change and listen to what we're going to do and get it done. If we don't have buy-in on the front line, nothing's going to happen. And we do that through a discovery and self-discovery type workshop and talking about best practices and so forth to get that start getting that buy-in, okay? And people are resistant to change, so you need that buy-in, okay? You need to understand, in the case of JB stores, there's multiple locations, and the culture's a little bit different at each location. The pain points are a little bit different at each location, and certainly the people and their abilities are different, okay? So once we've done that and they start believing there really is an opportunity to improve, it makes change a little bit easier. They don't realize how much work it's going to be yet at that point. But then we start developing a standard operating process in a lot of detail. And most dealers don't have it, or if they have it, no one is really following it. They may have when it was first initiated, but they kind of get away from it. But we don't give them a standard operating process. They have to build it. We kind of lead to the horse to the water so that they drink, but build that standard operating process. What do we want to be at the end of this project? What do we want to improve? Okay. And then you would think we'd start the implementation, but we don't. Then we start working on the structure to support that process. And that's what we did for JB. And there's a lot of structure elements. Okay. But the structure to make it more efficient for the frontline people to do their job and make it better for us to gather true metric information for coaching and accountability and so forth. Okay. Specific role descriptions. Okay. Key performance measures, process measures, which no DMS has all of that. And, got to build all of that structure before we can get to the implementation phase, and then ultimately the accountability side of that, building the disciplines to do it.
Hey, Mark, if I could interject, because you know we've got some listeners that have done business with us in the past, and they probably understood every word you just said, but we've got some people that know they've got an issue at shop, you know, either by looking at their metrics or they feel it. So one of the things you talked about was the beginning of the process starts with a self-assessment. Does that come from the dealer principal? Does that come from the lead service manager? Help me understand the self-assessment process and what they go through at the very beginning so that you can begin to formulate an approach for how to attack a project.
Well, typically it's a workshop with all the service managers there and the directors, if there are directors, or vice president of fixed operations. And we encourage the dealer to attend, and somebody from the accounting department to attend, because obviously we're going to dig into numbers. And I guess without getting too far into the weeds, first thing we do is analyze the financials. We're looking at, first of all, showing them what's in the financials. In many cases, in too many cases, they've never seen the financial statement, or they get parts of the financial statement and so forth, okay? So we start getting them to understand what goes into the sales categories. What do you do daily that affects the sales categories? And then we look at cost of sale, okay, and tie that to efficiency and the rates and so forth. And we talk about gross profit, which many of them at this point think that's profit when you're talking at the service manager or service advisor level, okay? And then we show them the expenses and what's finally on the bottom line, okay? At that point, they don't all believe that the statement's real, okay? Hell, I've got 20 technicians, we're fixing trucks all day long, and you tell me I'm only making 5% return on sales or whatever the case may be, or I'm losing money on sales in my department. Then we dig into the metrics off of their DMS system, and that starts supporting the financial statement, okay? But they still aren't there to the third step, where we pull repair orders and start reading and dissecting repair orders, because they touch and feel every one of those. They all the input on those repair orders are theirs, and when we start looking there, now it kind of ties it all back together, okay? And then of course we do a what if calculation to show them if they were at the average dealer level or the best in class dealer level, what that would mean in dollars and cents. Before we ever talk about how do we get there, they got to believe that there really is an opportunity, because, you know, I was on the other side of this when I was in a shop. Okay. And when my dealer told me my performance needed to be improved, I just worked harder and longer hours, right? Okay. There was nobody that showed me a roadmap in the beginning at all about how to get there or how to understand that. So that's key to show them that we're going to help them be successful, that we care about their success. And like I say, then we can start, we still don't start implementing until we start building structure, okay, and make it easier. I mean, walk into any dealership and tell them you want an estimate on every job every time, and they'll tell you you're nuts, right? But virtually every dealership that hires us for that kind of a project is doing that before we're done.
So it starts with a workshop, the dealership service operations team, the dealership's data, and by the end of that workshop, everybody's got a pretty good idea of what the issues might be and how to begin to start to structure a solution to improve the operations.
Yeah, that they don't all still believe. It's a longer process than that. Okay, there'll be one or two that are on board 100%, but all you got to do is get them over the halfway point at this point. Okay, I'm willing to give it a try. And we're pretty successful at doing that. And if somebody isn't, we know who that person is after spending that couple of days with them doing that, okay?
Gotcha.
And like I say, they build their own SOP, standard operating process, from that data. And it's just a narrative process at this point. We'll eventually turn that into a process audit and so forth, but it's just a narrative process of what we want to be, to be world-class, to be best in my market, however you want to term it, okay? And I don't give them any restrictions for cost or personnel or anything else. What do we want to be? How do we want to operate? How do we want to take care of customers? How do we want to make our profits and so forth?
So I'm going to tag team off of John's first question there. Why would a dealer contact you in the first place, Mark, to arrange a discovery? What would be something or some things that person would look at to say, maybe I want to learn more about this issue and how to address it?
Well, I think they listen to this podcast and they give me a call, right?
Okay.
No, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons, okay? From their 20 group, they don't like their ranking, okay? From the OE, they've been told that their performance is less than average or average, okay, or they've read an article or listened to one of our podcasts or listened to some of our webinars or read about us or maybe read about some other companies. And because they heard about us, they give us a call. And the call originally might be, I need more profit. Typically, it's not. I believe most of them want more profit, but typically it's not. I'm having a warranty issue. I'm having my efficiency is terrible for my technicians. Okay, I can't hire technicians. Yet when we start looking at some data, they're only selling 50% of what they're buying and so forth, but they're trying to hire more technicians. Okay, but it's, many times it's I'm not making money or I'm not making the money I think I should be out of fixed operations. Okay. I like to believe it's because of our reputation and these podcasts and the webinars and so forth. But I think a lot of it's word of mouth from dealer to dealer at 20 groups and OE meetings and so on and so forth.
So you talked earlier, you raised my attention when you talked about structure. Could you just comment on what you mean by structure, what that is?
Well, structure are the things that support the process, that increase efficiency in whoever has to do that portion of the process, wherever we can. If you do a value stream map of a process, you're looking to minimize waste in that process. In other words, if these 10 steps need to be done to get from A to B, which ones are of value to the customer, which ones are of value to the dealership, and what is pure waste? A truck sitting outside and hasn't been written up or brought in, is that time is pure waste. Maybe unavoidable right now, but we've got to find a way to make that not unavoidable, right? Okay. So not having a part in stock. You deal with parts all the time. Certainly it's trying these days with supply chain issues to have all the parts, but a lot of that is behind us. It's gotten a lot better, okay? And we just need to minimize it and take care of the ones we can get parts for and make sure we look at all the avenues, right? Okay. So you're trying to remove waste from the process. If I want to write an estimate every day without any structure, whether that's my DMS system, estimating system, or it's an Excel spreadsheet, or a product like Decisive, or I've also got to complete this Uptime Pro or this IH360 stuff and so forth. How do I put that together to flow versus everything is we're juggling all the time and forgetting it half the time, right? Okay. Because it's busy out there in that service drive, right. Very busy.
Yeah. Hey, Keith, structure is important. That's a good thing to poke at. The other thing I guess Mark had talked about a little bit earlier was, you know, everybody's version of standard operating procedures is a little different, okay? So Mark, I was wondering if I could poke at that because you said standard operating, they're dealership specific?
Dealer group specific. Okay, with minor changes from location to location, but yeah, dealership specific. A little secret, don't tell anybody, they're all 85% the same once they're done.
Sure.
But without going through that workshop, they never would be, if that makes sense. As I said, we're leading them to the water. They've got to start believing the best practices are really the best practices. So they're all 85% the same. The differences are in the geography, the market pressures, the personnel. In many cases, a service advisor does this at this dealer group, or maybe even a different location within the same dealer group. A foreman is going to do this part of the process and so forth, depending on how their personnel are aligned. The idea is to have a process that removes as much waste as we can, or at least starts us in that direction to start removing waste to be more efficient, which allows us to start creating flow most of the time in the shop. It's still a service department. It's not going to work 100% of the time, but we can get to the point where at least three or four nights a week, the service advisors aren't going home and yelling at the wife or kicking their dog because it was such a crazy day.
So you talked about, and John asked you on the SOP, do you have a standard template that you work from and you just make variations off of that? I mean, could somebody ask you for that template and
no.
They could just build it themselves?
No, we build them. As I said, 85% of each one is the same, but no, I don't have a template. I have a lot of copies of dealers that build it.
Right.
Okay, but no, I've had people offer to buy that from me, and it won't go anywhere.
Why is that?
If I sold it, because there's no buy-in. There's zero buy-in. All of a sudden, it becomes no different than the OE pushing down their next program. Okay. I am from the factory, and I'm here to help, right? Okay. Even within the dealership, if top-level management pushes down an idea to the service department, from now on, I want you to call every customer every day, which is a reactionary thing because customers are calling saying, I haven't heard about my truck, right? Okay. They're going to prove to you, not everybody, but many of them are going to take the time to prove to you that you're wrong because they believe you're wrong. All right. And some believe it more than others and so forth. But it has to be written by them. And it doesn't have to be perfect. It's a live document.
Right.
First draft of it just needs to be pushing us in the right direction, right? And then as they learn more and more, they'll want to make their own changes to it, revisions to it to make it better and so forth.
Okay.
Hey, Mark, I've got kind of a two-part question if I could impose on you. One of the things you talked about very early on in our discussion here was a lot of these guys never even see department P&Ls and have no idea what's behind them. If they were to show up on their desk or in a staff meeting, how about by the time we get to the end of your process, do our clients feel like the P&L that they're not seeing right now is an integral part of running their business effectively?
I think most do by the end of the project. And let me back up just a little bit. This used to be a lot worse 20 or 25 years ago. Okay, I would go in and start working with a service manager. He'd have cut out sections, scotch taped to a piece of paper once a month of his department. Or he'd have a handwritten financial result for his department. Okay, lumping all expenses together. Even maybe they didn't even show him the expenses, just the top part of the statement, right? Okay, and it's gotten a lot better over time. If you have a, you know, why does that happen? Why has it happened? You know, I think our culture 25 years ago was, we don't share that stuff with anybody. Okay, that's internal. I'm not sharing it out there. I don't trust those guys, or they don't know what it is anyway. Okay, and so forth. Okay, and I think that's changed drastically over the years. But unfortunately, too many of them still don't really understand. They can read the statement and know what total sales are, what total gross profit is, and what my net profit is or loss, okay? But if I'm working really hard and my team's working real hard, I start not believing that this statement's right, okay? I'm telling you, I was there myself. I did that, okay? And I still work with these service managers, and they're feeling the same thing too many times. Or this is impossible. The expenses they're putting on me are too much because I'm fixing a lot of trucks, and we're fixing them right, and we're kind of taking care of customers best we can and so forth. How can we not be making some money? I'm just trying to cover all these other expenses for all these other departments. They just don't understand allocation of expenses or why it's there or a lot of those things, okay? And I don't need them to understand it completely, okay? But simple things as if I want more labor sales, what do I have to do? Well, I have to sell more hours or I have to raise my effective labor rate. I have to stop discounting, okay, to get more labor sales. If I want more labor gross, well, I've got to do more labor sales either through raising my rate or more selling more hours or be more efficient on the repair so that I cut down my cost per billed hour on each ticket. So, and they've never heard that before, or if they heard it, they never understood it before. Right. But that's why we dig all the way down. We start with the financial statement, look at the DMS reports or whatever reports they get, but then we dig into the repair orders, and that's where you start getting them to buy in somewhat to the financial statement because those they control. They made those decisions. They decided this job was worth 2.1 hours, and the tech, every tech we looked at took 4 hours to do it. Why the heck are we selling it for 2.1 and so forth, okay? So it's a process, but you've got to have their buy-in. And like I say, before you tell them to change, don't make it 10 steps when it could have been 2 if we built the structure.
Okay.
Hey, part B of the question then, if I can, Keith, thanks for letting me cut in here in front of you.
Yeah, absolutely. But,
part B is, you know, we all know all of our clients don't use their DMS as effectively as they could. So in a typical project like this one, a service intervention, how much of our time is dedicated towards helping the dealers understand the nuances of their specific DMS and getting them to use the DMS as a better business tool to help them run a profitable shop?
Well, it's definitely part of the structure, John. Okay. The I think it doesn't matter to us what DMS system they're on. We work with them all. Okay. And even if it's something I've never seen before, we can figure it out when we're there, because we know what are the important parts that management needs to know to manage this department. And they all have that in some format. Some are a little bit easier to access than others, but then on something else, it's the reverse of that, right? Okay. We're good at pinpointing which reports need to be looked at daily, which reports should be looked at weekly, which reports should be looked at monthly, and then how to drill down based on the results. So, typically that only is on most DMSs, it's between 4 and 6 reports that you're going to look at least monthly. Oh, and the majority of them are daily or weekly.
Yeah.
To know where I'm going to be, to start understanding the financials and what the key drivers are that drive those financials.
Got it. Great answer. Thanks.
So, Mark, you've talked about all these things, and I'd like to come back to the structure piece in a minute, but from a dealer's point of view, if they're looking at their service department, what are some reasonable performance metrics that you would say, okay, you're in this upper tier, your service department is running well, or you know what, these are some metrics that if you're below that number, you might want to pay attention to that number. And I know not every metric, because you guys measure a whole lot of things, but what are some of the major metrics that you would say the principal, the GM, the service director should understand, and you know, if it's not at this level, maybe pay attention to it?
Well, I think from a high level, okay, gross profit percentage, all right, absorption for sure, what's your fixed absorption at least, okay, gross profit percentage, I would trend my labor sales and see if they're growing or if they're flat, okay, typically I like
in terms of hours, Mark?
In terms of hours, because dollars have gone up, right?
Okay. So
in terms of hours, okay. Is it gone up? Because raise your labor rate and your sales will grow up, okay? But you probably gave a raise and so did your cost. So gross profit and sales trending, okay. The gross profit percentage for your labor accounts should be around 75%. Some are higher, okay, but I would say an average good dealer is running at 75%, okay. Your expense to sales, labor sales ratio should be about 50%, 55%, I think, so that you're making on average 20% of labor sales on the bottom line. Now, there's a lot of other measurements, effective labor rate and productivity and efficiency and proficiency and so forth. And those, unfortunately, many times when we go into a dealership are not very accurate. And we can talk about that if you want. But that's your inventory, and it's managed poorly in too many dealerships. Not every dealership.
If you could, because I know that one of the things that you've talked about, not on the podcast, but that you've talked about in project review meetings and so forth, is that the data was not good, not right to calculate effective rate or proficiency or whatever it is. If you could expand on that just a little bit.
So probably the first thing that I run into way too often is just accuracy of technician punching. Particularly in a dealership, if you only have one or two places for them to punch a ticket or to punch in and out and so forth, that becomes a gathering point, and there's waste there as well. But accuracy in technician punching by line. Many stores believe they only have to punch on warranty tickets because it's required by the OE, and they do a very poor job of punching on customer pay and internal jobs. They may punch on and punch off, but not punch on by line to where you can measure their efficiency by line, by repair item, so to speak. Without that accuracy in punching, then productivity and efficiency don't matter at all. Proficiency is always real, or depending on the DMS you're on, it might be called gain-loss percentage. But either way, that's real. That is looking at the hours I sold, which every DMS has a report to show you the hours you sold for any time frame you want, versus payroll hours. So that brings me to the next point of structure. Many dealers today have a payroll system that's separate of their DMS. And if that's not being reconciled daily, the first problem is none of your reports are accurate. But the bigger problem is it's driving up your unapplied time considerably. Whether you put it to an expense account or to an unapplied time account or hide it or move time back onto repair orders or whatever, you need to see that time if you want to fix it.
I know. I've talked about that before between a friend of ours who, as a CFO, we measured proficiency, and let's say he reported 85%, but the service manager measuring it on the service side, because it was two different time punches, if you will, one payroll, one operational, he was measuring proficiency over 100%, if I remember right.
Right.
And it's because nobody reconciled those two. Is that right?
Right. And nobody, and then you get questions. Why do I have so much unapplied time? Okay. Or why are these indirect accounts or shop tickets or whatever they're using so high and so forth? Okay. So those, you know, it starts with that. What you're selling is the tech's time and expertise. That's why we're in business in the service department. That's why we do our measurements based on labor sales. We want the machine earnings. We want the sublet work, gas, oil, and grease if it's sold through service, and so on and so forth. But we focus on labor sales in the typical categories, customer pay, warranty, and internal. And there might be multiple internal accounts depending on how you're measuring it and so forth. All right, but to look at how much labor are we producing, and particularly if you're a dealer or if you're a general manager, if you're a director, if you're a service manager and you want to see how you're doing, find out what your real payroll hours were for a period and pull a report to show you the sold or billed hours for that same period. And did you sell 100% of what you bought?
Okay.
Or what percent of that you bought did you sell is probably a better way to put it. And the rest was total waste or melted ice, right?
Right. Okay.
So,
hey, Mark, I know a standard part of every engagement that you guys go through is looking at the repair order write-up process. And just curious if you could share with our listeners, you know, the reaction that you get when they see the variation that exists between the different shifts and the different service writers. Any reaction when you're going through that to the kinds of variation that exists, even within the same dealership?
Are you talking, John, about the time for the write-up or the accuracy of the write-up or standardization?
I'm talking more along standardization, but you could also talk this in terms of the quality of the write-up or the steps in the write-up.
Well, I think it's not just shift to shift or location to location. It's sometimes two writers or service advisors working next to each other have their own way of doing it, okay? And unfortunately, the customer, depending which one he gets the next time he comes in or talks to on the phone, whichever the case may be, is getting a different story or a different expectation is set for that customer or no expectation is set for that customer. So a typical standard write-up process on most of the SOPs that they write themselves includes trying to meet the customer at his truck. Sometimes we can't do that because of the way the shop's laid out and so forth, but going out to the truck for the write-up and getting all the information you need, okay, and truly, truly listening to the customer about why he's there. Now, this may have happened on the phone before it got there, and if so, was that documented so that when somebody does go out to the truck, we're not asking them the same questions we asked them on the phone and sound like we're idiots, right? Okay, we can just confirm what we heard on the phone. Okay, do a download from the system today. It's very, very common and usually dictated from the OE and measured from the OE and so forth. So that usually happens, but after the customer's gone. The advantage of doing it while the customer's there, if you have the right skill involved here, is doing a virtual analysis based on that code or a virtual assessment based on that code. If, for instance, if I see an after treatment code, that's probably not going into accelerated service or express assessment or triage or whatever you call that initial step in your process, okay, because it's probably going to be longer than a 2-hour diagnosis, or the chances are it'll be longer, greater chances of it being longer. So I want to set a different expectation for that customer. But the steps are, you know, pure and simple. When a customer walks in or calls on the phone or pulls up, act like you're glad. You don't have to really be glad. I know you're busy and you got more things to do than there's time, but act like you're glad. We are a customer service department. Listen really, really close and document word for word, if you can, what the complaint is, because that might help the tech diagnose it a little bit faster. Restate that back to the customer to make sure you've got an understanding. I can tell you story after story, because that step wasn't done. We made an assumption as to what was wrong and went down the wrong road. Okay. And then sell something. And by selling something, I'm not big at selling on the drive other than something obvious, but I want to sell what the customer came in for at this point. I'll sell more once I get the truck in and do an inspection and so forth. But I need a signature to do that, and I need to give them an estimate. My customers don't want estimates. That's because we led them down that road, and the customer thinks it's going to take too long, and that goes back to structure. Do we have the ability to build that estimate accurately and quickly and give it to them right now and get approval on it? Don't want to bring the truck in and have a misunderstanding about what this is going to cost, right? And that estimate at that time is just for the diagnosis or the specific thing they came in for. Now, you would tag on to the OE requirements and the best practices, doing a download, doing a walk around, taking pictures and those kinds of things. But we get a little bit more detailed in operation codes and segregation of those on the repair orders and so on and so forth. But that's the basics of a typical write-up that gets written up. And usually there's time limits put on it. If they're making the estimates with technology, all that wording is put into the SOP, step-by-step how to do it. If I'm using repair management, or if I'm using a Decisive product, or if I'm using an Excel spreadsheet, or I'm using the DMS estimating system, or whatever that may be.
Got it. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, Mark, last thing I've got, and then we'll see what else John has on this. You've talked a lot about the write-up and structure. I guess one of the pieces of structure that's always, and I don't know how you solve for it, so I'd appreciate you talking to it, is the structure, building the structure around communication, both internally, whether it's advisor to tech, tech to foreman, tech to back counter, and so forth to the appropriate people, or externally with the customer and so forth.
So you're absolutely right, Keith. It's very, very, very important. The biggest complaint from customers, as long as I've been around, which we have established in previous podcasts, it's been a long time, right? Okay, so the biggest complaint from customers is my truck goes into a black hole, I never hear anything. And when I call and ask for status, it sounds like they lost my truck. So if you think about a dealership, you guys have been around dealerships that you go into that is working with hard cards and not using the technology they have or could have, okay, unless I've got 125 open ROs. Unless it's a repair order I've touched recently, there's no way to keep track of 125 repair orders or where it is. If all the information and status and tech notes and so forth is on the hard card, now I've got to find the hard card to update this customer. So how many different places can that hard card be and so forth? A lot. I've seen it take 20 minutes to put together the status of a truck, particularly if the guy that was handling it is off sick or at lunch or whatever the case may be. So we're trying to stop all of that. That's the kind of structure we're talking about, okay? And internal communications drive external communications. Back to my example earlier of a dealer that asked his people to update every customer every day on the status, it's impossible if I don't have the structure built, which is why they believe it's impossible, and they're going to prove to the dealer that he's wrong. Or lie to them and say that they did, right? Okay. So if I use any of the DMS systems, I can access that job. If I have Decisive or Uptime Pro or IA360, repair management does it, okay. Everybody has technology that I can't think of one that doesn't, okay, to tell me where that is. All right, without finding the repair order. However, I've got to get my internal communications up to the right level in order for that to be useful. In other words, if it doesn't get entered into that technology, some of it's automatic. If I order a part, it shows. Some of it's automatic. If I've punched on a job, it shows. But for instance, if a tech is leaving for the day and a job is not done, does he update his notes with status? Because the night shift foreman might get a call on that and he has no idea, no tech to go talk to find out what that status is if it isn't put into whatever technology you're using and so forth. If it's all there, when a customer calls and wants status, I can quickly access that, quickly read the notes, and come across to the customer as if I'm only managing his truck. That's a big, big plus, because like I say, it's one of the biggest complaints from our customers today, especially fleets. Now, if we're really doing that well, it becomes really easy using text, using email or phone calls to proactively update that customer before he's expecting the next update. And we're the ones that set that bar. We're the ones that say that part should be here Thursday. As soon as it arrives, I'll let you know it's here, but scheduled to come back in the shop Thursday. And then we forget about it, and we don't call him on Wednesday when the part shows up. But he's thinking about it too often, right? If there's a change and that part's been delayed, we don't call him until he calls us and wonder why his truck isn't done Thursday. If it's Thursday afternoon and we've given the customer an estimate and we told him he could have it Monday at noon, and he said, man, I really need that truck for this weekend to run this load. Is there any way you can get it to me? He might stop and call the foreman, and the foreman's busy and says, well, we'll try. Tell him we'll try. So he comes back and says to the customer, we'll try. The customer hangs up thinking he's got a good chance of getting his truck. The foreman forgot three other jobs and it's not going to Tuesday, and we've got an upset customer. And probably a lot more juggling going on in the shop and so forth. So it's very, very important, but you have to have, there's systems out there today that the job, that when JB went paperless, and they're not by far the only dealership we've helped go paperless, okay? But in order to go paperless, you've got to work out these foundational pieces, have the structure and the disciplines in place before you do it. But once you do it, everybody has access to all the information at any given time live.
There you go. John, what else do you have for Mark?
You know, Keith, I'm good. We've covered a lot of ground here today. You know, I think everybody could be better in their shop. So I think that's the number one thing that now the solutions there's probably a lot of common elements in all the solutions, but the customization that goes with Mark's intervention, I think, are really what make us unique and different, really what makes the intervention worthwhile and profitable for our clients.
I would agree with that. Mark, anything else before we recap what we talked about?
No. I mean, there's a lot of things we could dig into, but I think we get too deep in the weeds, okay? Use the technology you have, but build it into your standard operating process, integrate it into your standard operating process, and continue to try and find ways to reduce waste for your frontline staff, which will result in reducing waste for your technicians, which produce your revenue.
Well, thanks, Mark, for educating us. Every time I've listened to you in 20 years, I learned something. Keith, most of the time, it's good.
A lot of meat on this bone today, right? Well, Mark really brings it, doesn't he?
He does. You know, these are, I know, John, you've been exposed to some of these projects that he and his team do. They're pretty large projects, and in many cases, he's changing habits that people have established, you know, their whole work life in many cases. So it takes some time.
The whole emphasis on buy-in, I think, is critical. Yeah. We talked about a lot of great things today, but the effort that he goes through to get buy-in and keep these projects moving forward is really important.
Yep. We've talked a lot about throughput, tech performance, you know, getting the measuring right, the data accuracy, getting structure built, ultimately trying to drive more capacity through the tech, through the bay. Mark, how about next month? Let's close this these four sessions of service department off with talking about managing rate, and we'll have kind of squared this whole circle. What do you say to that?
Sounds like a great idea.
All right.
I love it when I get to talk the most.
I know. We like it too, because all we have to do is ask questions.
I'm usually pretty shy and afraid to give my opinion, right?
Yep. Well, guys, thanks again. Appreciate your time as always. And for those of you listening out there, if you would like to enlist Mr. Whitnell's assistance with learning more about your used truck inventory or what's happening in the used truck market or just the dealership in general, please reach out to John. He's more than happy to visit with you. If you'd like to talk to Mark more about service, he can be found on the Key Advisors website. And if you ever want to visit with me, I'd love it as well. Drop us a line about any topics that you'd like us to address on this podcast. So, gents, until next time, we're the Three Wise Truck Guys, and we're out of here.
Howdy, hope.